This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Okay, well, Tony Perkins is not here, but Sandy Rios is, and I'm happy to fill in for Tony. Honored, actually. Tony's out doing something very important. I'm confident of that. And so I'm sitting in his stead. And let me just say that I do the morning show for American Family Radio from 8 to 9 a.m. each morning, talking about what's going on in D.C. And then I also represent the American Family Association in Washington. So that's who I am, in case you're wondering why I so freely give my opinions. All right. There are a lot of important things happening, and one of them was happening in the Senate today, where Neil Gorsuch, the candidate for the Supreme Court, was testifying before the senators on the Judiciary Committee. Patrick Leahy asked him a question about religious freedom, and I thought you might like to hear. Let's listen.
Do you agree with me that there should not be a religious test in the United States?
I need to know more specifically.
Well, let me give you an example. Should there be a religious test to serve in the military?
Oh, Senator, that would be inappropriate, yes. That's against the law. That's against the law.
Or, of course, we go right back to the question, do we ban people based solely on their religion? Solely on their religion.
Senator, we have the religious...
Not on whether they form a threat or something, but you ban somebody solely on their religion.
Senator, we have not just the First Amendment free exercise clause in this country. Very important protection. We have not just the equal protection guarantee of the 14th Amendment, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, gender, ethnicity. We also have the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, as Senator Hatch mentioned, which was a bipartisan bill passed by this body with support of Senator Kennedy and Senator Schumer when he was in the House. And that imposes an even higher standard on the government than the First Amendment when it comes to religious discrimination. It says that if there's any sincerely held religious belief, earnestly held religious belief, the government must meet strict scrutiny before it may regulate on that basis. Strict scrutiny being the highest standard known in American law.
Well, religious freedom is a huge issue for those of us that are Christ followers and serious about it. And no one knows how crucial an issue it is than my next guest, Kelly Shackelford, who's the president and CEO of First Liberty Institute. Kelly, thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Sandy.
All right. There's a lot to ask you quickly because time will go so fast. Today in the hearings, did anything in particular stand out to you as we evaluate Neil Gorsuch?
Really, what stood out for me was what an excellent choice he is. I mean, I think anybody who watches any parts of the hearing realizes what a quality individual. Just brilliant, gracious, humble, and yet totally the kind of judge we all want, which is somebody who's not going to assert their own opinions, but somebody who really feels bound to follow the law and to really show judicial restraint and not sort of trying to push what they want, but to do the right thing by what the law says and to let the legislature be the legislature and judges do their job and not be legislators.
Well, Kelly, since your business is to represent people on this issue, it's the First Liberty Institute, after all, that you're the president of. And you, we've talked so many times, and I'm familiar with your cases. You always inspire me, so I have to say that. But there are a lot of things pending in court right now. And as you think ahead to Neil Gorsuch, you know, perhaps sitting on the Supreme Court, what kinds of things are hanging in the balance that a man like him would be hearing?
Oh, wow. We've got, I feel like we're surrounding and at the Supreme Court with the numerous cases. I mean, we had a case argued today at the 10th Circuit. We have a case being argued tomorrow en banc at the 4th Circuit, which means instead of just three judges, we're going to have 15 judges. That's about whether you can have prayer before a county commissioner's meeting. The one we had today was a young lady who was actually told that by police that she was not allowed. She lives in government projects. She was told she was not allowed to pray in her own home. And that was being argued today at the Federal Court of Appeals. These are the kind of cases that, I mean, I tell you, with Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, I would feel very, very good. I don't think, Sandy, I have seen ever any justice being nominated to the Supreme Court that has the number of decisions on religious freedom and that are every single one so solid as Neil Gorsuch. I mean, Hobby Lobby, Little Sisters of the Poor, Summum case. I mean, I could keep going. These are great opinions. And sometimes he had to be in the dissent. Sometimes he had to be in the majority. It depended upon, you know, what the people in his court were doing. But he was right every time, and he was solid on religious freedom every time. That, you know, we just haven't seen that kind of evidence before. When we've had somebody going up, we're always like, boy, I think you'll be really good. Maybe there's one opinion or two opinions, but he's got 3,000 opinions that he was a part of, and a number of those religious freedom, and wow, he knocked them all out of the park.
Now, the question has to be asked, of course, because there's so many comparisons to Scalia, since, you know, Scalia is our justice that we lost, who made so many fine decisions and was so colorful in the writing of them, and a man that we all admired, I think. How would you compare his decisions on religious freedom to Neil Gorsuch?
I actually think that Neil Gorsuch is probably going to be stronger on religious freedom than Scalia. Justice Scalia, you know, had a lot of great opinions, and you know, as you say, was one of the more enjoyable people you ever met. Just a joy, and brought laughter to the courtroom, and had that Italian energy. And was just a real champion of especially the structural constitution and the separation of powers and a lot of that. But he wrote one of the more controversial decisions on the free exercise clause. And I think Gorsuch is more likely to write, you know, supportive of both the religion clauses, both the free exercise and establishment clause. So I think that you'd find he and Scalia would probably be pretty close on the establishment clause, but I think Gorsuch would be even better on the free exercise clause. We'll have to wait and see. So I actually think, you know, and I know people have predicted that he would be probably, if you looked at the spectrum, he would probably end up being a little more conservative than Scalia, but not as conservative as Thomas. And I think that's probably a good guess, but we'd have to wait and see.
I did not hear the full. I didn't hear all the hearing. Who did? You know, who has time today when they're working? Which I was, and I'm sure you were too. But I think Patrick Leahy was actually. I think my impression from the, what bit of the question I heard was that he's trying to set up a Gorsuch for to answer the question about whether there should be a religious test for immigrants, mainly Muslim. I think he was trying to tie it to the immigration order. So, Kelly, I guess. It's a little troubling. I mean, surely we must, correct me if I'm wrong, our religious freedom, First Amendment, does not apply to people who want to come to this country when they're not in this country yet, does it? I mean, do we have, I'm not saying we should have a religious test. I'm not advocating for that. I'm saying it's not precluded, is it? That's a thing that protects American citizens.
Yeah, obviously it applies to American citizens. I would say this. I mean, it's kind of a silly discussion. I know it's the basis for the Hawaii decision somewhat in part, but I really think it's silly. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks that people are being denied coming into the country because of their religion. They're taking the fact that they're from countries that are of a particular religion, but the reason that those countries are of a particular religion is because that's where the terrorists are coming from. And this is a list that was created not by Donald Trump, but by Barack Obama when he was president. So, you know, what he said, the question that Senator Leahy was answering, you can't, you know, discriminate against someone in this country solely based upon their religion, is absolutely true. We have a religious test, you know, provision in the Constitution as well, that we don't use a religious test for people in this country. But I don't, I mean, again, I just think that kind of stuff is disingenuous. I mean, everybody knows this is about security and those issues, and that's the analysis. So I don't know, I know where he was trying to go, but he can't get there because he kept saying solely because of religion. And I just don't think that anybody really believes that that's the real reason. And I think when this other case gets to the Supreme Court, you know, and they get to a real court at that point, I think, you know, that order will probably be upheld because the president has a lot of power and Congress has a lot of power, and Congress gave that power to the president. So you have sort of a a separation of powers, you know, real power that was given to the president in this situation.
Over immigration, yeah, statutorial exactly. And by the Constitution. Yeah, absolutely. It's just bizarre, isn't it, that a Hawaiian judge just randomly could think of just any reason and stop the order and make us all, I hate to use this term, it's becoming so used, overused, but less safe, you know, truly.
Well, and you know what's interesting, Sandy, is they used the test. He used the test that, I mean, I would have never expected immigration to mix in with religious freedom, but there's a test called the Lemon Test, and it's accurately named because it's just a horrible test. It's used. It's just so malleable, and so what happens is judges use it to strike down what they want, and they use it to uphold what they want, and it really has nothing to do with the Constitution. That's what this judge used to say it was some sort of religious violation. And what they did is they said, is there a secular purpose for, you know, whatever, you know, action they're analyzing? And in this case, he said, well, we know what it says would be a secular purpose, but we've got all these statements from when President Trump was candidate Trump, and so we're gonna figure out what we think he really was doing and what his motivation was, and that's just not the role of judges. And I think that's why it's so fun to see somebody like Neil Gorsuch, who you would never see engage in that type of sophistry. I mean, Neil Gorsuch is going to say, "What does the law say? What is the original meaning of this? What are these words?" He's not going to sort of start crystal balling and saying, I think I know the heart and intent, and it's not what's on paper. That's the kind of thing that, you know, really leaves the judges totally without control, because they can just do whatever they want. I think there's such a dramatic contrast when you watch Gorsuch, when you watch his hearing, and you see his reserved nature, his humility, his whole idea that he's not running everything. He's just doing a job that he's being appointed to do, which is to interpret the words as they were written.
Kelly, if you were on that committee, the Judiciary Committee, and you had a chance to ask a question, is there anything you would ask Gorsuch that was not asked?
You know, I think the thing I would be tempted to do, and I know a lot of the senators and stuff are asking questions to help, you know, respond to some of the sillier charges. It's been really weak, the other attacks, but what I would be fascinated to do is just ask him about judicial philosophy, not only his, but the opposing philosophy and why it's wrong and why it's damaging to the country. Because I think it would just be an opportunity to educate people. I think most of your listeners, you know, understand this. It really is like the pastors that are out there these days that think, well, the Bible is what I want it to be. And that's what's happening with some of the justices. They think the Constitution is, quote, a living, breathing document, and that they look at what's popular these days and they try to insert that into the Constitution. And, you know, you don't really have a Constitution at that point. You have the Supreme Court being this ultimate legislature that decides everything for us and takes everything out of the legislative process where the citizens, you know, have feedback and have the ability to make a difference.
And let's just say that Neil Gorsuch is not one of those. And you know what? That is a great idea, Kelly. I think you should get that to your favorite Texas senator and have him ask that. We have to take a break, but we have to say goodbye to you. Kelly, it's always a pleasure. Kelly Shackelford, First Liberty. And by the way, it's firstliberty.org, firstliberty.org. They have great information on their website about the various cases that they're representing. Kelly, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you very much, Danny. And I will say, go to TrumpNominee.com.
Whoa, we have not had a response like this before. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We've been doing these spiritual heritage tours for like 20 years. We're sold out for June already, if you can believe that. We've got space left on our September tours of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon, and then Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. We call them spiritual heritage tours, and I don't know how long these September seats will last. To what do you attribute that to, someone might ask? Maybe it's the fact that we have a new person occupying the White House. Maybe that has something to do with it. But in any event, we welcome you to come with us on our September Spiritual Heritage Tour of Washington, D.C. and Mount Vernon and Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown. Those are two separate trips. You can do both, or you can do one or the other. We'd love to have you. Go to spiritualheritagetours.com. spiritualheritagetours.com.
American Family Radio, equipping you to change the culture.
AFR has been a tremendous positive influence for us. I've been searching and searching to find something that would give me actual facts and statistics, information about the things that are going on in our world from a Christian perspective, and AFR just fit that niche perfectly. Abraham Hamilton, absolutely live. And I've been telling everyone I know that you need to turn off your TV and listen to AFR and get facts to know how to apply to our daily lives. I just wanted to let y'all know that. I know that Satan's bombarding everyone with negativism. It's not going to do any good, but you are making a positive impact. So thank you for every effort. Thank you for your programming. I listen to it all day long.
Your partnership makes a difference. Join us for our 3-day share-a-thon starting April 4th. American Family Radio, boldly standing for truth for your family.
From Samaritan's Purse and Franklin Graham comes Facing Darkness. In 2014, as the Ebola virus was devastating West Africa,
the numbers of new cases and deaths are still rising.
International relief organization Samaritan's Purse stepped up.
God has called us to care for the dying, to care for those that are suffering.
We can't say we're Samaritan's Purse and not help.
My phone rang. One of our doctors, Kent Brantley, as Ebola.
And then David looked at me and he said, you too have Ebola.
We're there to save life. We're there in your name. Why?
Despite the fact that things were out of control, we knew that God was in control.
God puts you in places and supplies the strength to deal with.
Jesus Christ didn't run. We run to the fire. We don't run away from it.
Facing Darkness, a true story of faith. In select cinemas for one night only, Thursday, March 30th. For theaters and tickets, go to facingdarknessmovie.com. That's facingdarknessmovie.com.
So I'm just looking for something that would indicate that you would give a worker a fair shot. Maybe it's in your background somewhere that I don't know about, but I'd like to have you respond to it any way you can.
Senator, I really appreciate that. I think there is a way you can take a look at this question without me potentially prejudging a case. And I appreciate your respect for that. And just to finish that thought, I'm concerned that I have to look the litigant in the eye in the next case. And if I prejudge that case, they can look at me and say, you're not a fair judge. And I've got no answer for that. I've got no answer for that. So what I think can give you comfort in this area is, Senator, I know a case or two has been mentioned yesterday. Respectfully, I'd suggest that does not represent the body of. I've participated in 2,700 opinions over 10 and a half years. And if you want cases where I've ruled for the little guy as well as the big guy, there are plenty of them, Senator.
All right, so that's the first part of that clip. That was Senator Dianne Feinstein. Of course, they're trying to paint Neil Gorsuch as a guy who's all about the rich and not about the regular guy. They made that attempt. They've thrown a lot of things at him, and they just have not stuck. I think it would be a good thing for you to hear the rest of Neil Gorsuch's response to Dianne Feinstein so that you can see how really effective he was in the hearing today. Let's listen.
Would you be willing to submit some of them?
Oh,
it's
goodness.
It's hard to read 2,700 pages.
I'll name a bunch of them right now.
I mean, Trans Am.
I'm sorry, Senator. Of course. Ute 5 and 6, Fletcher, the Rocky Flats case, which vindicated the rights of people who had been subject to pollution by large companies in Colorado, uranium pollution. I point you to the magnesium case, similar pollution case in the Salt Lake City area. Colorado's effort with renewable energy upheld that. Or versus City of Albuquerque, involving pregnancy discrimination in the police department in Albuquerque. WD Sports, a discrimination claim. Casey, Energy West, Crane. Simpson versus CU, involving young women who had been harassed by the football team. AM, Browder, Sutton. I can give
that's
you a long, long
that's
list.
And we'll find them and we'll read them.
And Senator, the bottom line, I think, is that I'd like to convey to you from the bottom of my heart is that I'm a fair judge. And I think if you ask people in the 10th Circuit, is he a fair judge, you're going to get the answer that you got yesterday from both Senator Bennett and Senator Gardner, and from General Katyal, and the same answer you got from Senator Allard and Senator Salazar 10 years ago. And Senator, I can't guarantee you more than that, but I can promise you absolutely nothing.
All right, so that was Neil Gorsuch. It's good for us to hear his voice because these nine people that serve in the Supreme Court, you know, really do make decisions that affect our lives and affect unborn lives. In fact, you might wonder how Neil Gorsuch, what he said when he responded to questions about life. He's written extensively about it. He has said that Roe versus Wade, he has, I forgot his words, and I shouldn't put words in his mouth, but he's written in support of that, again, in favor of life. But he says, I think that Roe versus Wade is settled law, something to that effect. But so you'll be interested to know how he responded today. I know they're concerned that he is very pro-life, and this is what he said, clip 16.
In that interview, did he ever ask you to overrule Roe v. Wade?
No, Senator.
What would he have done if he'd asked?
Senator, I would have walked out the door. It's not what judges do.
All right, so, you know, we've come to a place where we can't, I think it's unfortunate, actually, that we can't ascertain where judges stand on issues. I recognize that they can't say how they feel about certain things because, allegedly, then we'll know how they're going to adjudicate. Honestly, they should do what Neil Gorsuch says repeatedly. They should not be making laws. They should look at the legislature, the Congress, to see what they've passed, look at the Constitution. They should rule simply on the statutes and what's there, not on their personal opinions. But it'd be nice to know their personal opinions. But I think that Neil Gorsuch has enough of a record, even though I don't think he's ever ruled directly on a right-to-life case. He certainly has written extensively about it, and I think most of us in the pro-life movement are pretty comfortable that his inclinations are to protect and preserve life. He's written a very long paper about that, as a matter of fact. By the way, this is Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins. I know it's kind of a jolt, but Tony's not here today, and I'm happy to help in any way. FRC, of course, is a leading organization in Washington, D.C. It's like our think tank, the Evangelical Christian Think Tank. They do great work. And so under the leadership of Tony, they've just flourished. And I want you to know that you can get some of that great information at frc.org, frc.org, or you can go on Twitter with Tony Perkins, and his Twitter handle is tperkins. No, I always want to say .com, but that's not right. It's at tperkins. That's it. Just leave it at that. I should know that. Mine is at Sandy Rios Tweet, if you care to join me at Sandy Rios Tweet. Busy people have trouble tweeting a lot, but it is a valuable tool because you can give sometimes the most important articles or most stunning or remarkable pieces of information you get right away, and people that follow you then can pick those up and share them, and so it's kind of a valuable tool. I'm going to talk to you next about a little more discussion about the Comey testimony before the House yesterday, because other things have happened today. You know, Judge Napolitano actually was suspended from Fox today because of his claims that according to people that he's hearing from, that Barack Obama and others were involved in surveilling Trump Tower and Donald Trump himself. So Judge Napolitano has been suspended, and I've been talking about that a lot too. So I have some things to talk about with that. Also, we're going to be talking about the health care bill, because you probably know that the House is going to be voting on Thursday on repealing and replacing Obamacare. It's very complicated, and yet it affects each and every one of us. And so it's such an important issue. How many nightmare stories have we heard and have many of you experienced on the coverage, the so-called coverage of Obamacare? You know, it doesn't matter if you have health care. It doesn't matter if you have coverage if you can't actually get care. If you have a piece of paper, that's great. But if you still have to pay out of the pocket thousands of dollars and pay thousands of dollars for your premium, then it really isn't very helpful. And so it's been kind of a nightmare for the American public. And so the move is being made to try to repeal and replace it. But it, too, has become complicated. And we'll get to that in just a second.
making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Well, the only economic news that we can really look at is what's going on globally. We've got China, Germany, the Eurozone seeing some interesting numbers coming out, and most of them are pointing to some poor global growth coming out of some very critical areas of global economies. We also see a report, very interesting, based on what I said yesterday, that Saudi Arabia's oil supremacy is faltering. Do you think? I believe it started some years ago, and they are no longer going to be dominating the oil markets. And this has some of the oil markets, particularly those internationally, scrambling. Eurozone's inflation is up. The UK's inflation jumped to 2.3%. It's the very first time in the UK that food prices have been on the rise since April of 2012. This could be a problem, although they have worked very hard to get some inflation, but they really didn't want to see it go too far over their 2% target. It goes to what I've always said, that no central bank or government is going to control inflation once it starts, and maybe it is some cause for concern here in America. Germany is trying to hit back on some trade policy spat that it's had at the G20 meeting, and that is going to be interesting to watch how Donald Trump reacts to that. Frankly, the whole idea of trade wars aren't going to happen, but I do believe we'll see some countries like Germany changing their policies. And of course, China in the news right now as they continue to see corporations owned by the state falling dramatically. Another China telecom drops 10.2%. And we're looking at China very concerned about default on some of their debt.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
Sadie Rios back with you, filling in for Tony Perkins. Thanks for joining us today. And I meant to tell you when Kelly Shackelford was with me that First Liberty has developed an entire webpage where you can watch the hearings with Neil Gorsuch and you can find out the latest information. And if you'd like to do that, TrumpNominee.com. 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 And so I meant to do that in the first segment, but I want you to know that's a great source of information about this because we're going to get a flood of information. But, you know, certainly First Liberty is a trustworthy source, and that's really important in this day and time. All right, well, yesterday, as you know, because I talked about it a great deal, and you saw it on television, I'm confident, you saw FBI Director Comey testifying on Capitol Hill to the House Intelligence Committee about alleged Russian ties or interference in our election and also alleged Russian ties with the Trump campaign and also then the President Trump's claims that he was wiretapped in the Oval Office. I made it pretty clear yesterday that I come down on the side of believing it's quite possible and actually likely that Trump has been under surveillance. I don't understand why that's such a stretch. When you consider that Michael Flynn was in Trump Tower when he was surveilled, his entire conversation was put in a transcript and leaked to the Washington Post and CNN and other sources. Donald Trump, when he became president, we suddenly had transcripts of his conversations with world leaders, including the Mexican president. Now, who did that? Just wondering, you know. You may, and as we said yesterday, wiretapping is an outdated way of surveilling, so it's not the proper term now. It's surveillance, which is much more complicated. I just think, I don't know what President Trump knows about this. I've told you what others have told me about it. And how can we be sure? You know, Director Comey said, we've checked inside Justice and the FBI, we can't find anything. Well, it doesn't sound to me like it would have come from Justice or the FBI. So that's probably true, but not complete. But I wanted you to hear an exchange that I thought was really interesting. I picked up on this later. This was a question to Director Comey. Now, he's there. He's a law enforcement agent. He's supposed to know the facts of the law and the facts of the case. But he was opining on something that I thought was pretty interesting. This is it.
Let me begin by asking you, do you think that the Russians expected Secretary Clinton to win the election?
Yes, as of August, certainly. August, September.
Okay. Mr. Rogers?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Comey, you indicated as of August, September. Do you believe they ever came to a conclusion that, you know what, Mr. Trump's going to win?
No, the assessment of the intelligence community was that early on they thought he might have a shot. And so they wanted to mess with our election, hurt our country in general. That's always the baseline. They hated her, Secretary Clinton, wanted to harm her and thought it might have a chance to help Mr. Trump, and then later concluded that Mr. Trump, it was hopeless, and they would focus then on just trying to undermine Secretary Clinton, especially with the European allies.
Got that. So up until summer and through the fall, they believed that Secretary Clinton would win. Is that true?
I think the assessment was late in the summer, they concluded, based on the polling I think a lot of people were reading, that Mr. Trump didn't have a chance, and they shifted to just focusing on just trying to undermine her.
Now, can you know that? I'm just saying, can you know that? Can you actually get inside the motivations, or you just read documents? I'm not the only person that kind of had the eyebrows go up at that point. Mark Stein, who's one of my favorite commentators, was on with Tucker Carlson last night, and this is what Mark had to say about that.
Well, I think they're mad at Russia because they want to believe that they did not lose the election, that somebody stole it from them. And that's why what we saw today, frankly, was nuts. I mean, the Democrats, as you said, they've turned Putin into a Bond villain, the man with the spider's touch, as that congresswoman almost sang today. They're two sound bites from insisting that they're going to build a new Berlin Wall and get Russia to pay for it. This is going nowhere for them. It's a massive head fake. And if you did subscribe seriously to the theory that Putin was trying to mess with America, what do we have now? We have an interminable investigation that is designed to drag down the United States government. This investigation, this furor, is actually doing Putin's bidding more than having some cabinet secretary in his pocket would. So today's hearings were bizarre in a very particular way. And when someone like Comey says, you know, oh, Vladimir Putin absolutely hates Hillary Clinton, what business is that of a domestic law enforcement agency? Why is the FBI wasting its time trying to figure out what Vladimir Putin thinks of some washed-up has-been presidential candidate?
All right, so, yeah, nobody says it better than Mark. And I would have to say, just to remember that the friends of Hillary... Man, the names are just escaping me. The Defense Intelligence Agency, Clapper, and Mike Morrell, both stated that there was no evidence of collusion with the Trump campaign, and yet the director is saying they're going to go on and on with the investigation, which reminded me of a story that I heard just last week that there was going to be investigations of conservative congressmen. Nancy Pelosi started this by instituting a policy where anonymous sources could accuse them of something. And then they had to spend the rest of their 2 years there trying to defend themselves with unbelievable bills because the allegations just kept coming. And often they'd be based on false stories planted in their districts. And that's why we've lost some conservative congressmen even as we speak. So all of these games are played. Investigations lead to, they can always find something. So it's going to go on and on and on and on. And somebody's going to have to stop. It can't be Jeff Sessions because he's recused himself. All right, we're going to talk about Obamacare, kind of, when we return. Sandy Rios, in the afternoon. Washington Watch.
One of the great freedoms that most Americans enjoy is the ability to get involved in political campaigns. But what about pastors? Unfortunately, due to a little-known amendment that was passed in 1954 at President Lyndon Johnson's urging, churches and other nonprofit organizations are prohibited from making statements for or against a candidate for public office if they want to remain tax-exempt. This is just one of the many problems with the Johnson Amendment. Not only does fear of IRS action put a chill on the free speech of pastors, it restrains other nonprofit organizations from participating in the debate of public policy in their area of expertise. In addition, the IRS only rarely enforces the Johnson Amendment, causing widespread confusion about what constitutes lawful political speech and what doesn't. For more information on how to amend the Johnson Amendment, visit frc.org/Johnson Amendment. That's frc.org/Johnson Amendment.
consider serving with Friendships. It's an all-volunteer ministry providing aid to disaster victims, refugees, and the impoverished here at home and around the world. We're now taking applications. If you're available to serve without pay, you can be part of the crew reaching out to help people in need. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Join Norman Geisler, Richard Land, Michael Brown, Frank Turek, and others for Southern Evangelical Seminary's National Conference on Christian Apologetics. It's October 13th and 14th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Enjoy informative talks, a live debate, and a dialogue with Ken Ham from Answers in Genesis. Plus, there's the premiere of the American Family Association documentary, The God Who Speaks. Register by May 1st and receive a special gift. Visit ses.edu for details.
Steve Tiber of 8 Days of Hope.
Our great country continues to get slammed by natural disasters, hurricanes and tornadoes, flooding. I mean, it's everywhere from Texas, South Carolina, to Georgia, Mississippi, all throughout the country, our country has suffered. Here's where you and I get a chance to be a glimpse of Jesus. It is so cool to meet a homeowner who has gone to no fault of their own. Their world has been turned upside down, and you get a chance to bless them. You know, we tarp roofs and do chainsaw work, and we gut homes that flooded right after disaster with our rapid response team. And then we also look to rebuild homes with 8 Days of Hope, like we've done 12 different areas of the country. 1,800 homes, $25 million of damage. People all the time say, man, you're good. Well, we're not that good, but he is great. Be a part of something unique. 8 Days of Hope.
Learn more at 8daysofhope.com.
Finally, we want a very big tax cut, but cannot do that until we keep our promise to repeal and replace the disaster known as Obamacare. Obamacare has been a complete and total catastrophe, and it's getting worse and worse by the day, and yet you watch the fake media, the fake news, and they try and build it up. It's a disaster, fellas. It's a disaster.
President Donald Trump last night in Kentucky, thousands of people there encouraged always by spending time with him, enthused. They certainly never hear anything positive about the president in the media, so it's nice to see him face-to-face and hear him talk. But we have a very serious problem. The House Republican leadership is pushing through a plan to replace Obamacare that many, including myself, I'll just say it right up front, are very concerned about. It's called the American Health Care Act. Remember that the Obamacare plan, passed 7 years ago, hard to believe, has become a disaster. There's just no other way to say it. And people are eager, and not just eager, but desperate, really, to see it done away with. And many of the people who serve in the House, in fact, most of them probably, at least certainly Republicans, pledged to repeal Obamacare. And I think the big point to be made, if we don't say anything else in this interview, is that this particular bill that Paul Ryan and the leadership are presenting does not do that. Rachel Bovard is the Director of Policy Services at the Heritage Foundation. Rachel has been all over this issue, and I'm eager to find out what she knows today. Rachel, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let me just say up front, Rachel, Heritage also has a lot of problems with this. You guys have been watching it closely and doing some great analysis. And so this morning, the president met with Republicans. What do you know about that meeting?
So it sounded like it was a rally of the troops kind of meeting. However, I think two big things came out of that meeting, and the first was that, you know, the president was very clear about what he thinks. He's thrown his weight behind this bill, and he's basically saying to Republicans, if you don't pass this bill, it's going to cost you seats in the next election. This majority depends on passing this bill. It's a really blunt statement from the president. He also came out against, not quite against, but he called out Congressman Mark Meadows, who is the chair of the House Freedom Caucus. The House Freedom Caucus has still not thrown its support behind this bill. In fact, they've been very vocal critics of it. And the president said, hey, Mark Meadows, I'm coming after you, you know, whatever that actually means. But so he came in to really get Congress behind, get Republicans behind the Paul Ryan plan, even though many conservatives still have issues with it.
Yeah, big issues. And I have to say, I don't want to get stuck on this yet, Rachel, because I want us to tell people why we're concerned. I want to just make it as clear as we can. But Mark Meadows and the Freedom Caucus, to me, are heroes. They are the ones who really have stood by Trump. They are not the leadership who actually refused in many cases to help him, including Paul Ryan. These are the true blue guys who represent us faithfully in Congress and take their licks. And they have some very serious concerns about this bill. And it's really, it's not a good thing to see this president, who many of us were so relieved to see him elected. We heard him say things we loved and supported. And so it's not a happy place when he then turns against the stalwarts that are aligned with much of his base. But Rachel, let's talk about this bill, Ryan Care. I think that's a safe thing to call it. What are the chief concerns? Let's see if we can make it clear. Why aren't you guys in favor of this at Heritage?
Well, I think the first big reason is that it doesn't repeal Obamacare. You know, it keeps a lot of that fundamental architecture in place. And in doing so, it doesn't actually address any of the cost drivers, any of the big thing, you know, the big issues that made Obamacare so expensive, made people lose coverage. You know, the major, major things that we want to try to address, this bill just doesn't solve those problems. So, you know, I think that's issue number one. Issue number two is that it keeps that Medicaid expansion. That's a big deal. And when Obamacare was passed, most of the coverage under Obamacare was predicated on this massive expansion of the welfare state. And the Ryan bill keeps that in place. And now they're tweaking it slightly. We saw some new language today that's going to tweak it slightly, but it still doesn't get rid of that incentive that states have to load up able-bodied people onto Medicaid. And remember, Medicaid is a federal program that was put in place to help the very, very poor, the disabled, the elderly, you know, single pregnant mothers. And so we're taking resources away from this very, very vulnerable population to cover, you know, single, able-bodied 20-something dudes. And that's not, you know, that's not solving the marketplace. That's not solving healthcare in America. It's simply loading them up on another government-run healthcare program, which is not very good, which is not a very effective program. There's a number of other issues in the bill. You could talk about the backdoor mandate. Obviously, the bill gets rid of the individual and employer mandate, but it does allow insurance companies to charge a 30% tax on people that don't have health insurance. So it's sort of another way of, you know, the government forcing people to purchase something.
Yeah, Rachel, let's sit with that one just for a second, because a lot of these terms, you know, you're familiar with, and I am somewhat. But let's just make it really clear if we can. In other words, under Obamacare, you were forced to buy it, or you were going to be penalized. There were penalties. But under the Ryan plan, it isn't that the government will penalize you, it's that the insurance company will. And it's my understanding, if you don't pay your premium for 60 days or 61 days, I think it is, like, if, let's say you run into hard times or something happens, you lose your job. If you don't have continuous coverage for 61 days, the insurance company can raise your rate, as I understand it, by 30% for a full year. So this is like, it's not helping people, it's helping insurance companies.
Right, and I think you're kind of focusing in on the real issue here. And that, you know, conservatives have said, look, Obamacare is a policy failure. We know this. This is proven fact now. We need to fully repeal it and start over and actually reform the marketplace. And the goal here is to make healthcare affordable and accessible for everyone with free market reforms. This bill doesn't do any of that. It doesn't repeal Obamacare fully, and it doesn't start to address those market reforms that will make affordable, accessible care.
Rachel, what is it not repealing?
So a couple of things. The initial bill did not repeal the Cadillac tax. It repealed all the other Obamacare taxes.
Okay, so what's the Cadillac tax?
The Cadillac tax, as people may recall, is a tax on basically nice health care. So if you get really good health care plans through your employer, the Cadillac tax will tax you and your employer on that plan. The original bill did not get rid of that. The new tax that we've seen, if it passes, may address that issue, but that's still to be determined.
All right.
But most importantly, it does not get rid of the regulations that Obamacare implemented at the Health and Human Services Department. Now, you know, people have said, oh, well, Tom Price can address those. Well, he can't address them fully without direction from Congress. That's why we have, you know, the three branches of government. And so there's two big regulations that were not addressed that we know for a fact were part of the reason that prices under Obamacare skyrocketed. I mean, you saw premiums for families going up 140% in some cases. The two regulations most responsible for that are not addressed in this bill, and that's a huge problem for a lot of conservatives.
Well, my understanding is, Rachel, as a result of that, premiums are actually going to continue to go up.
Yeah, based on the CBO score that we saw last week, premiums will go up until they go down in like 10 years or something like that. And that does get at the issue. Cost is really important. In fact, in a lot of studies, we've seen that for many people, cost is more important than coverage. You know, people will choose to go without care if they don't want to pay the money for it. So letting people purchase plans at costs they can afford, that they choose, is very, very important. And Obamacare priced a lot of those plans out of the marketplace, you know, because of these essential health benefits, which basically tell insurance companies, well, you have to cover all these things for every person. So it's the reason why, you know, a single 20-year-old man who's healthy, if he purchases insurance, his insurance will have maternity care, even though he doesn't want to pay for that.
And that's under this due plan, too.
That is left in place under the
due plan. Yeah, and I was reading the same thing but different. A 60-year-old person who doesn't, you know, plan on getting pregnant will still have to pay for maternity benefits. And so
right.
it is really government-controlled and structured. It's not like you can shop for the plan that fits your circumstances. It really does continue to take away freedoms. All right, the tax credit, you know, I know the taxes were a big issue initially for the leadership. They wanted to keep those taxes and tuck them away and save them and use them for their new plan. What's happened to that?
So the taxes are mostly repealed, almost all of them. And I think the last one may be addressed in this new manager's amendment. So that is a good thing in the bill. And, you know, to give credit where credit is due, I think it would have been very easy for Republicans to try to keep that revenue. It's $1 trillion in taxes that Obamacare put onto people. But to their credit, they took those out and they said, you know, we're going to repeal these taxes. That's not fair. So those taxes are dealt with. The bill does create a whole new bracket of tax credit to help people purchase insurance. And now many conservatives view these as creating a new subsidy program.
Yes. Why not?
Right. So
I mean, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to give our tax dollars to people to help them buy, what more is that besides an entitlement program?
And a lot of conservatives would agree with you. The movement, you know, has differing opinions on it. But what we do know about the program is that, you know, it's age tested. So basically, you know, based on age, will depend on the size of your tax credit. But the tax credit doesn't even go to the individual. It's a check that's cut directly from the government to the insurance company.
Again.
Right. And so as my boss, Senator DeMint, has said, look, if you're going to do that, at least give it to the individual to allow them to put it in their HSA and choose what kind of care they spend it on. But we can't even do that. You know, it's a direct transfer of taxpayer money to the insurance company.
Well, Rachel, this is what I've heard directly from almost the horse's mouth, depending on which horse you're speaking about, but the forces behind this plan are on K Street. And I'm going to name names and you can plead the fifth. Carl Rove, former Boehner staffers who have crafted this bill, who are connected with the insurance companies and also with pharmaceuticals, and they have a lot to gain from this. And that's the tragedy here for me. This is the same entity that's using money to run against these Freedom Caucus members in their districts if they don't support this plan, but you're positioning it as though they are not supporting the president, that they're not in favor of, they're refusing to repeal Obamacare. I just think that that has to be exposed. It's just, it's a terrible thing to allow happen. And you can comment on it, or you can say, I'll plead the fifth.
Well, I mean, I think it's a real shame. You know, all the things, you know, that you said are tragedy. I agree with that. But I think it's a real shame that this is the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Republicans, not just to repeal Obamacare. I mean, they've been talking about that for a long time. But to really push some of these market reforms that they've been talking about, not just for the 8 years that Obamacare's been in place, but for decades. I mean, purchasing cross-state lines, associated health care plans, fixing the tax parity between employer-sponsored care and the individual market. These are things that Republicans have made part of their platform for almost a generation now. And this is the one time that they have to really get these ideas out there and vote on them and shape them and put them into place. And yet we're here too busy creating entitlement programs and loading up people on Medicaid. It's just a shame to miss a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to reform the healthcare marketplace.
Rachel, is there an easy way for you to tell us if Heritage were king, which has had a lot of influence in this White House so far, thank God for that. If you could have the healthcare program that you think would work, what would it look like?
Well, it would start with repeal first. We know this can happen. It happened in 2015. The House and Senate passed a repeal bill that was almost full repeal. We know it can happen. Do that again. Get it out. and then start to rebuild this marketplace with some of the free market ideas that we just talked about. You know, have that full debate. The 2015 bill, repeal bill, actually had a two-year phase-out built into it. So what it basically did was it repealed Obamacare, but no one lost their coverage immediately. They would, you know, there was 2 years for this Congress to really transparently debate plans and to get it right. You know, there was, we weren't up against these deadlines. We weren't, you know, up against the wall with all this leadership pressure. They had 2 years to really debate some of these free market principles to get it right. And that's what, at Heritage, that's what we'd like to see.
Yeah, okay, so tomorrow, Thursday morning is the vote. And my best information is that the Freedom Caucus is holding steady. Maybe, I don't know if 100% of them are, but most of them are. I've got a list, at least, from published by NBC, if you can trust that list on from NBC. So how many people, how many can they afford to lose and still get to 218?
Well, 22 will take the bill down. So it's a very, very tight margin that they're working with. And I've heard numbers tossed around today, you know, between, you know, 22 and 35 no's. I mean, this bill is not a lock. There is definitely a lot of room here, and if you've watched to the House floor at all today, you've seen the leadership team working the floor, you know, really trying to press members. I know the Freedom Caucus is going to meet with Trump at the White House again tomorrow.
Oh, really? Okay.
You know, I think there's some last-minute wooing that's going to take place.
Thank God for that.
You know, and hopefully, you know, President Trump will listen. To be fair to President Trump, up until this point, he's been a good partner to conservatives. You know, Paul Ryan had no intention of negotiating with conservatives at all, but he had to because, you know, they went to Trump and Trump heard them and said, you know, Paul Ryan, open up your bill to hear these guys. And so I think that's the hope again that, you know, they'll say to Trump, hey, we want to support this bill, but this is what we need, you know, and that Trump will hear them.
Yes, I hope so, too. And, you know, this is his first foray into complicated legislation. And I do think the president should be praised for his attempt to bring the sides together. But where we land is also very important. And it's not just a matter of reaching a compromise. It's reaching a really good place that will give us freedom. We are not a socialized country. We are not Europe. We are not Britain. We are not Sweden. We are the United States of America, where we make our own decisions, take care of ourselves, and help those that just absolutely can't. We need a safety net, no question about it. But we are not obligated by the Constitution to provide health care for every single person. We can't. Possibly, Rachel, we have $20 trillion plus in debt. And with that, I'll quit preaching. What last word do you want to say, Rachel?
Well, I would just kind of back up everything that you just said. Look, we know that the government can't do this. We've tried. Obamacare is a policy failure. But what we do know is that the marketplace works. And we do know that we want everyone to have access to affordable care. And the way to do that is to get rid of Obamacare and start to reform the marketplace. So I hope maybe between now and Thursday, Republicans kind of do an about face on that. But you know, that's, I think, where we would stand at this point.
Rachel Bovard, thank you, Rachel. It's great to talk to you, and I appreciate your input today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Sandy Rios in for Tony Perkins, Washington Watch. This is a matter of prayer. These are good men who are really trying to hold out tonight. We need to pray for the members of the Freedom Caucus, from Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows and Justin Amash and Dave Bratt and Raul Labrador and Mo Brooks, and if I had time, I'd read all of them. But they're trying to do what's right, and so we need to pray. I think the president is, too, and perhaps the leadership in their own way. I don't know. Maybe they are too, but we need to have something good that benefits this country. All right, thank you for joining me. It's frc.org, at T. Perkins for Twitter. For me, it's at Sandy Rios.
Washington
tweet, Sandy Rios in the morning.
Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.